for me a way how to introduce them one after another. I will probably start with the Canadian dimension of this group, and that is Paul Wilson, who at the time was just a young man, a young teacher, who decided.
Thank you, David.
who decided to, in 1967, decided to travel to Czechoslovakia. And surprisingly or not, he stayed there not only through 21st of August 1968, but he stayed there until 1977. Not only as a teacher, but later on as a translator, interpreter. Most importantly, he got involved with the dissident movement. He got involved with Václav Havel, who he became a good friend, and he interprets or translates all the works of Václav Havel into English. Actually, it's through Paul Wilson that some of you may know Václav Havel. And in 1972, Paul Wilson became the member of the band Plastic People of the Universe, which was the rock band which originally did not try to be political or have anything against the regime, but because they were playing rock music and they were not hiding their contempt of the communist regime, they basically pretty soon became the number one list on the number one on the blacklist of the communist government. And soon majority of the band was imprisoned, and in 1977 Paul was expelled from Czechoslovakia. This band, Plastic People of the Universe, is coming to Toronto to play in exactly 1 month and 1 week, and I'll be more than happy to give you more details about their tour. But they are not the main focus of this evening. We are focusing much more on the 1968. So, going further through Canadian dimension, I think I would go to Joe Schlesinger, who came to or who left Czechoslovakia already in 1937, and in third. And throughout his life in Canada, he became a very well-known person, a household name. And it happened that in 1968, exactly on the 21st of August, in the night, he was having dinner with his wife in a Toronto restaurant. He, at that time, was executive producer of the CBC, and immediately upon the enter of the Russian tanks into the, or Soviet tanks into the Czechoslovakia, he was called to duty, and he was reporting on what was happening in Czechoslovakia at that time. He was not present in Prague at that time, but I know that throughout his life he held his contact with the Czechoslovakia, with his Czechoslovak roots. And I can tell you that his Czech is better than mine, so that tells you something about it.
Oh, my, I hope your Czech is better than mine. So what is a cell phone in Czech? I don't know you.
What is what?
What is a cell phone in Czech?
Mobile. That's a different Czech. That's not the old Czech, the Vančura and Čapek's Czech. You know the other one. I will give you just a very brief description of every single one. Please feel free to ask more. I would move to another Czech-Canadian connection, who is sitting, as always, humbly in the corner. And it's my dear friend Joe Čermák, who at that time, in 1968, was leader of the Czech community in Toronto. Not only at that time, he was basically a leader of Czech community and one of the most important parts, persons of the Czech community, starting in 50s until actually now. 1968, his biggest involvement happened right after he came back from his several week vacation in Prague. He actually left a couple of days before the Russian entry.
No, I wasn't there for several week vacation. I was there for a visit to have a room going on. And I was there about a week.
I still get many facts not correct, but thank you very much for correcting me. Later on, once Joe and the Czech community found out what happened in Czechoslovakia, they wrote down a memorandum. Actually, Joe was the main person behind the memorandum, which was presented to Prime Minister Trudeau. And upon this memorandum, and other things, other documents, and other development in the community, helped to facilitate thousands and dozens of thousands of Czechoslovaks who were allowed to enter Canada much easier than it would be without the memorandum. One of the people who may have benefited from this memorandum and this visa waiver, I would call it, was George Kvoretsky. Joseph Kvoretsky was a prominent writer already in '60s in Czechoslovakia, and I strongly believe that he is the best living Czech author. And I'm very grateful that he accepted our invitation today, and I know that he will share deep knowledge of what was happening in the Czechoslovak society in the late '60s, because he was one of the main figures of that time. Joe, upon his arrival to Toronto with his wife, quickly established the publishing house 68 Publishers, the single most important publishing house which was concentrated with the dissident literature, and which basically sent back to Czechoslovakia hundreds and hundreds of books, which helped us who were there inside find out what the real literature looks like. It would not happen without the help of people like Peter Bakewell, who was in the mid of '80s. He served for 2 years at the Canadian embassy. He was not only serving as a diplomat, but he was the main connection between the Czech dissidents outside of the country, or those who were supporting the Czech dissidents inside, and everybody who stayed behind the Iron Curtain. Had we not have these connections, such as Peter Bakewell, I don't think it would be possible for 68 Publishers to have such a wide impact on what was happening in Czechoslovakia. So Peter was, and he will tell you much more in detail what he was doing, but basically through the channel, and through the channel which was created by Peter, the Czechs inside of the country had a chance to read whatever 68 Publishers and other writers outside of the country were writing. That's the introduction. I wasn't as short as I was hoping to, but I basically cannot omit number of facts. So I will now give the floor to Paul Wilson, and please quarterback the situation, because you are the one who is the centerpiece. You know everybody, and I would like you to give us some.
I'm hardly the centerpiece. I'm just a witness, an observer. But happen to be almost at. I've just a quick background. One of the reasons I ended up in Czechoslovakia was because of Jan Němec, who made this film. He made a film called Of the Party and the Guests, which was a very famous film in the 1960s, which I saw in London in 1966 at a Czech film festival, and. I didn't realize it at the time, but Joseph and his wife Zdena were one of the stars of this film, because Jan Němec was one of these directors who uses his friends and acquaintances as players, and so it was a fictional film. It was a story, but the amazing thing is that when I first saw this film, I didn't know anybody in the film, I had no idea that it was Joseph or it was Dena, or any others as well. But when I just before they expelled me from Czechoslovakia, somebody they had a kind of a celebration to sort of say goodbye to me, and they brought along a pirated copy of this film, and they showed it in this farmhouse. And I realized that I had, in the 10 years that I'd been there, I'd met just about everybody on the film. There was Eugene Niemetz and his family, his little children, and Joseph and Zdena. And there was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of your colleagues, Joseph.
Sure.
Sorry?
Yeah, sure.
That's right. That's right. But you and he had these text appeal readings. There was another. There was a writer who played the Lenin character.
Viscoccio.
Right. So it was kind of a nice bookend. But what I'm so having seen this film with Jan Niemetz, I was more interested in seeing whether I could see any recognizable faces in these crowds, which I didn't. But what I'm curious about is how the rest of you reacted to that film, what your responses were to it, because this is the first time I've seen this film. Joseph, you perhaps could start, because you were involved in it somehow.
Yeah, I was involved in the original version, which was to be a sort of propaganda film for the Dubček government. And I wrote the commentary to it. And then on the last day of filming, another film of mine called End of a Priest, which was a feature film. So I left with my wife for Paris, and we wanted to go further to the Riviera for the first time in our lives. And we spent the first night in Munich on our way. And when I woke up in the morning, I switched on a portable radio, and the first words I heard was "Heute Nacht hat die Czechoslowakei von den Russen besetzt." This night the Russians occupied Czechoslovakia. So that was my awakening. And so then we stayed in Paris with a very good friend who was also a political exile. He was Spanish, and he ran away from Franco. So we were his guests for about 2 weeks or so, and then we decided to return back to Czechoslovakia. But after another 2 or 3 months, we saw that there was really no hope for us to stay there, because if I had stayed there as a writer, I would either have to remain silent or write things agreeable to the government, or go to the underground and be executed by the police, which at my age was not a very good outlook. So we decided to leave. I was in Prague until August the 20th, because they came at night. And Niemetz made this film, and one of the cameramen, I understand, was killed during the filming, actually. And then Niemetz left Prague and went to Vienna, and then he cut the film, and I saw it in Paris about a week later. And this is the first time I saw it since the time. So it looks very fresh and very interesting to me, but I miss these events, you know. But I saw some of these people, like the foreign minister Hayek. I was at a party that the Czech gave for writers in Prague, and we were sitting with Havel with this Mr. Hayek, or Comrade Hayek, I don't know. And I asked him how will they manage to reinstate democracy into the country and retain the leading role for the party, because that was the big question. All right, so there were political parties not permitted, only 3 were permitted. And so he said he took a piece of paper, they made 2 thick lines, and it, between the two lines he drew some spirals and some zigzaggy lines and said, these are the different movements, and this is the river, this is the Communist Party, and within this river's banks you will go into, I wanted to say the sea of oceans, I don't know, but somebody behind me said, Dupada. You don't understand Czech, but you can probably imagine
the English counterpart would be up yours.
That's right.
So that was my, you know, it's usually described as a time of great hopes. But it was also a time of great forebodings and bad forebodings. I never believed that the Russians would not come. And I remember I was in the jury of the first Czechoslovak beauty queen contest in Moravská Ostrava, with Miloš Forman and Niemec and others. And one of the cameramen got a little tipsy and he kept shouting, tanks are coming, tanks are coming. And nobody wanted to acknowledge that because everybody hoped that the tanks would not come. But everybody more or less expected them to come. And it happened. So, and you saw it in the film, which is very remarkable. Niemec was really a very, very remarkable filmmaker. But now, of course, the film industry is privatized. And the kind of films that he made are not involved anymore. Right. I don't know what he's doing now, but there are some.
He made several movies upon his return back to Czechoslovakia in the early 1990s.
He made a Niemec film right after his return, which was still his old style, but it didn't have any response from the audiences. What he's doing now, I don't know. He made a very touching film, moving film, about his mother, which was quite beautiful. But I don't know what he's doing now. But he's also no longer a young man, you know. He must be in his 70s. When I met him, I was about 10 years older than he is. But I'm now 84, so he's probably 72 or something like that.
Anyway, I recommend that if you get a chance to see this film of the party and the guests, that you rent it. You can rent it from the butcher shop, I believe. Anyway, it's worth seeing. But what you said was interesting, because I think that it was, according to this film, the way the Prague Spring was depicted up until the 20th of August, it was a time of great hope and optimism, but I think it was also a time of great illusions. As you also pointed out, and I'm wondering, my own response to that is that when I was living there at the time, and I thought I understood what was happening, but I don't think I really did. And I was wondering if especially the shall I say the people who can remember like Joe and Joe, that was your second occupation, right? Yeah. Not the first; it was the second. So, what were the differences in you know, between, I mean, Joe, can you talk about that? The first, you were quite a young fellow at the time of the German occupation.
Well, let me tell you something. I saw this thing here. This?
Yes.
Plus ça change, plus ça reste la même chose.
That's true.
This could be George Bush tells Russians, get out.
Yes.
It seems to, you know, it never seems to stop. And again, he's as old as I am, or even a little older, years older. You know, I remember watching the Germans coming in 1938. I was chased down the street by Hitlerjugend in 1938. I left in 39 in a sealed train through Nazi Germany during that. I came back in 45. In 48, I watched the communists take over again. You know, it's just. And then in 68, it happened again. But the nice thing about it is that I finally went after, let me see, 39, 50 years after I left, I was in Berlin for the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I heard on the radio, it was November the 17th, that there were some student demonstrations in Prague. And I knew what it was about. It was about Oppenau. So I got my little horse, went to the Czech military mission in East Berlin, and got myself a visa to go to Prague. And I tell you, going back 50 years later, going back and seeing it all collapse. Now, it doesn't get any better. It does not get any better. And I remember, you know, this when I got there, the 17th was a Friday, I was there, I think, Sunday night, and these demonstrations in 89 were slow getting kind of started. There were a lot of people walking on Wenceslas Square, walking up and down the sidewalks, so I'm thinking, do I or don't I? And I would stand there and do my, it's called a stand-up in television, you stand over, you know, you do a commentary. And the crowds would gather. And some people would go, so then, Chlapčíka, you know, what is the guy saying? So I would tell him what I was saying. And my crew got to call this Jonas Nightly News Conference in front of the statue of St. Wenceslas. But 68, you know, I remember 68, you said I went out for supper with my wife. I'd been at work. It was a quiet August night in a year in which we had the Tet Offensive, Martin Luther King murdered, Bobby Kennedy murdered, Democratic Convention thing. I don't know whether Kent State was before or after, I forget now. Like, I was the executive producer of the National, and it was like, so this quiet evening seemed like a good time to go out and find me a dinner with my wife. So when I got back, I didn't drink water or anything. That was one of my things. We got correspondence into Prague. Of course, they didn't speak Czech. And I could just sit there. But that night, and this was in the days before you had 101 signals on the television and all that sort of thing, and 24-hour news. And a lot of people still watch the CBC National News, at least a million and a half years ago. And they must have been puzzled that night because the National started with a shot of Hradčany and a few bars of from Vlast, Smetana's symphonic poem about Bohemians. And I was guilty of sort of self-indulgence, of sort of letting it go, letting it out that night, because all those memories came back of all the humiliation before, and seeing it happen again. Not that I was surprised, but still, yeah. It goes right in your gut somewhere.
Well, Joe, you left Prague in 48,
49? By the way, as I listened to you, I was surprised how good your English was. And then I realized that you are Canadian born.
Okay.
But anyway, I had some experiences too. I was born 1924 and 1938. Nazi came, I spent 43 to 45 in a forced labor camp. And then I was arrested at Benesh funeral. I spent a couple of weeks at Ruzyna prison, and then I left. I think it was very silly of me because I could have expected great things to happen to me. I have been in jail for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But anyway, 1968, there is an interesting connection between Josef Škvoretský leaving and Toronto. At that time, I was discussing with Gordon Skilling and Catherine Poyer, who were both professors at the University of Toronto, setting up a program in Czech and Slovak languages and literatures. And Josef Škvoretský was supposed to be the first professor at that program. Unfortunately, he decided to go to San Francisco. Was it Los Angeles?
San Francisco.
I thought so. But anyway, eventually he came to Toronto. The film itself, I was deeply moved. I haven't seen it before. And it's a lovely piece of work.
It's a what?
It's a lovely piece of work.
Peter, you said you were too young to remember, but you surely must have remembered, or registered at any rate.
Well, I did, because I was an Englishman in those days, and my sister and her entire class went to Prague that year, she met a boy who had the opportunity to come to England, and they spent some time together. All that ended very abruptly. But I'm anomalous in another way, because as these events were unfolding, I was busy reading myself into Trotskyism, and was a 68 art, as they call them. And I remained a Trotskyist for 2 years while I was at university, the first 2 years at university. So, you know, what the Russians had done was no surprise to Trotskyists, right?
I mean, yes.
It made absolute sense. And we sort of just took it in our stride as students in those days. The emotional impact is not there for me, of course, because of my age at the time. I remember it very well.
What year did you spend in Prague?
Well, you were there. You came in the documentary in 1988. I showed you around the city.
Yeah, that's right. What did you?
Yes, and you interviewed Václav Malý.
That's right. I mean, the reason I came in is because I was in Berlin with Ronald Reagan when we made the speech about the war falling down, and Joe Clark had gone. Had you gone to Prague or etc. And well, that was 1987. Joe Clark put in a word for me to let me in to visit my family.
So what does it all mean? I mean, one of the things that Havel's fond of saying is that when people ask him, you know, about 1989 or his presidency, he says, look, it's not for me to say, it's for up to the historians to say. And it's been now 40 years since the invasion. It's been 40 years since the Prague Spring. And looking back on it, I mean, was it a harbinger of 1989? Was, you know, the old Czech joke? What's the difference between Dubček and Gorbachev? You know that joke. The answer is there's no difference at all. It's just that Gorbachev doesn't know it yet. This was a joke from the late 1980s. And you know, if you look at the history of the Prague Spring, an awful lot of what Gorbachev tried to do systematically happened more or less spontaneously. I was living there at the time and frantically learning Czech because there was so much to read and so much to talk about. And one of the most remarkable moments was when they suddenly lifted censorship and all these newspapers could come out and people could say things, and then, as this film showed, things started reviving. Old organizations started reviving, like the Barashnitsky, whoever they were. I know them only because there's a pub in Prague called Na Barashnitsky Rikhtje, which we used to go to a lot. But the Boy Scouts were revived. There were political prisoners organizing. And it really seemed to me, when I was watching it at the time, that things had kind of slipped out of the hands of the Communist Party, and things were happening outside the banks of this river. I mean, there were things mm-hmm. happening on the riverbanks and things happening back mm-hmm. in the woods. And to me, it simply seemed that my interpretation at the time, I wasn't a Trotskyist, but I was fairly left-wing at the time, and my interpretation was, well, you see, socialism is a very flexible doctrine. It allows for all kinds of different things. But that's not how the Russians saw it, obviously. But the thing that I was not there at the time. I also left on the 18th or so to go on a holiday to Yugoslavia, and I was in the town of Split when I saw a bunch of Czechs standing around a radio listening to it, and I said, what's happened? They looked at me and said, you don't know. They told me. Anyway, I got on the first train to go back to Prague, I arrived, I think, on the 25th or the 26th of August when the tanks had been moved off onto the side streets and things had sort of more or less calmed down. I think that was the day that Dubček came back from Moscow with his government. But the interesting thing is that I met a lot of journalists there at the time who at the end of a couple of weeks, they decided, well, it's over now, time to move on to the next thing. And it always seemed to me that and the reason why I went back and stayed was because I wanted to understand what happened afterwards, what happened next. And this is something that people who are on a daily news cycle can't afford the luxury of doing. Because it was probably a year before the Russians actually reestablished their total control, or rather the Czech communists who were in the Russians' pocket. And that always struck me as an interesting time of transition, when these hopes for 68 were still actually alive up until probably the spring of 1969. And what really killed it were the demonstrations when the Czechs beat the Russians in hockey. There were riots in Wenceslas Square. And then the anniversary of the invasion, there were huge demonstrations in the middle of Prague. The Lidová milice, this sort of armed branch of the Prague of the Communist Party in their coveralls and their guns, went through Prague. There was shooting everywhere, and that was really the end of it. But it took a whole year for that to happen, and so the other thing that was odd to me was that looking back and looking forward. And this is something maybe you can comment on, and it brings us back to Plus ça change theme, which is, it struck me that here were the Russians invading a country, or this, I should say, the Soviet Union, invading a country that they already owned. And I tried to think of an example of the Soviet Union invading a country they didn't own, and I can't think of one. Maybe there is one, but it's a very odd form of military diplomacy that they employ.
What is ownership?
Sorry?
What is ownership?
Well, I mean, having a government that's having people in place that are inclined towards them, right?
Yeah. But, okay, I'm a prisoner of the new cycle, right?
Yes. So
my new cycle goes back to the Reformation. to the Hussites.
Right.
First of all, we're talking about communists.
Yes.
There ain't no such thing. You know, in China, I've just come back from China. In China right now, they have a Communist Party, which is either capitalist or Confucian, but not communist. I mean, communism, Marxism is dead. And even when they had Marxism, the communism in Russia, communism in China, communism in Poland, communism in Romania, communism in Yugoslavia, were all very different. And they were different for reasons of, shall we say, the DNA of the society on which they were sort of put. So you said this invasion by the Soviet Union. It was an invasion by the Russian Empire. But it called the Soviet Union or something else. And the Prague Spring was, in a sense, a replay of, if you will, of the Hussite movement. You know, of suddenly saying the church is all wonky, the church is wrong. And the church was the Communist Party. So this is not something that just happened overnight or in the news cycle. This is something that's been brewing for centuries, both in the Czech Republic, in China, and elsewhere.
You mentioned that maybe things got out of hand. When I was visiting Prague...
I didn't think they were out of hand. I thought they were getting in hand, but that's how they thought. Yes.
When I was visiting Prague in 1968, I visited Ludwig Václavík. He, as you know, is the author of 2000 Wars, one of the reasons which obviously was given for invasion. And he just got back from Chernobyl. And he said it just hangs by a hair. And then he said, you know, I blame Dubček to some degree, because Dubček convinced all his comrades that the Russians would not interfere. And they believed him because he was partly educated in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
So that's the comment.
Right. Dubček is an interesting figure because I'm not sure. I mean, do you think that Dubček was actually in control of things? I mean, he's presented. I mean, he's the face of socialism with a human face. But was he calling any kind of shots at all? Was he in power? Did he have any kind of influence? Or was he just a figurehead? I mean, I don't know the answer to that.
But whatever he was doing, he was under pressure to do. I mean, having been educated in Moscow, this was a natural, not a natural thing for him to do. Yeah. It must be precious on him, even if it was a figurehead. That figurehead reflects pressures in the society or the party or whatever you, in the power structure.
Right.
It doesn't come out of thin air. He didn't one day wake up and say, oh, I think I'm going to be a Democrat.
No, he didn't. He wrote an interesting autobiography that he never finished because he died before he finished, but a guy called Uzi Hoffman or Hochmann finished it for him.
Hochmann.
And it's written in his voice. And what I get from reading that autobiography is that he was actually, if he'd been born in Chicago, which where he was probably conceived, and had grown up in Chicago, he probably would have become a Chicago politician, because he seemed to have a natural kind of political bent. He knew
like
how to smile.
Like Obama or Daley?
Sorry?
Obama or Daley?
I'm not thinking of any parallels. But you never know. The first Slovak president of the United States, who knows? Anyway, it always struck me that especially reading his autobiography that he actually was a political player. He actually did maneuver Novotny out of office. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize or understand at the time that I was living there, that he was merely the representative of a huge movement inside the Communist Party, which was also happening because of pressure from the outside. Anyway, let's move on to the normalization period, which is something that you have seen from the outside, and I've seen a little bit from the inside, and Peter's seen from the inside. One of the things that is interesting about Havel's kind of take on the 1970s was that it wasn't the same as the 1950s. It wasn't simply a return to the old system. It was a new system that the Russians and their Czech puppets put in place. But it was slightly less crude than the system in the 1950s. And according to Havel, that allowed room for a certain amount of dissent, even though it wasn't necessarily allowed. So I was wondering, I mean, looking at it from the outside, I mean, Joseph, you got all these books coming through, and I can remember just a quick anecdote. Joseph's books, rather, the books from 68 publishers, circulated quite widely around Prague. And they were referred to at a certain stage of their circulation as Salatove Edice. Salatove. Salad edition. Because they were bound with glue, and they were read by so many people that by the time you got them in the circle of friends, the pages had all come loose, and they were just sort of these loose pages held within covers. They were incredibly well read, incredibly widely read, and this was a tremendous lifeline to the people who were trying to keep their ideas and their individuality alive. But how did it look from Toronto?
We did not smuggle these books to Czechoslovakia. You left them to other organizations.
Yes.
We didn't want to know about it. Who is it? Right. Who is it who sells the book and brings them to Prague? Because it's better not to know about such things. And you can get drunk somewhere and you will split the beans, you know.
Right.
So we were just producing the books. My wife was really it was my wife's idea in the first place. And she was the manager, if you want. She did everything. I was the editor-in-chief. I read manuscripts and decided which ones should be published, which ones should not. So I did the editorial work. And besides, I was, of course, at the university. I had to teach. But education, I was not a Czech teacher, you know, as Joel said, that they wanted me to become the head of the Czech department, but I had no qualification for that, because I studied philosophy and English, so I became a teacher of American literature mainly. And so we published also two American writers, by the way, are familiar, who wrote a play about the normalization in Prague, the bishop's ceiling, and Philip Roth, who wrote a short novel about Prague. So these are the only two foreign writers that we published. Otherwise we published dissidents who found ways to smuggle manuscripts out to us.
You've got a scene in The Engineer of Human Souls where one of the main characters, Mrs. Sanerova, runs a publishing house, Lex 68, and there's this hilarious scene where somebody comes from Prague and they have a manuscript, and they do all this sort of conspiratorial stuff, and Danny, the narrator, meets this guy in a washroom at Union Station. Yeah. Was that a true story?
Well, it's a true story. It's a little embellished, of course. It wasn't that funny, but it's a true story, and it came out that this manuscript was worthless.
Well, it was something like a continuation of the protocols of the elders of Zion.
Yes, it was an anti-Semitic,
anti-Semitic text.
Yes.
Is this true? I mean, this is an amazing story.
You know? As I say, it is a little embellished, you know.
Right.
But basically, it happened. We really met at a washroom at the Union Station. The manuscript was thick. You know.
It was shoved under the
partition. It was not good. They couldn't publish it. They wouldn't publish it anyway.
Of course, it wouldn't.
Okay.
Well, it's there was conspiracy on the other end as well, because in addition to having your books and other books in this sort of salad form, which showed how widely they were read, people also put covers on them so that they could read them in the streetcar. I still have, as a souvenir of that time, a copy of Animal Farm that I lent to a friend of mine, and he put the front page of Rue des Pravos on it as a cover, so we could read an Animal Farm in it.
Well, I know people used covers from American paperbacks,
right.
Stories,
right.
On Watsulik's book.
Right.
Well, it's surprising how many books made it through.
Right.
We didn't expect that, but it was quite well organized, but not by us. We were
right.
Just the
people. Do you well, know now how it was organized? Have you met the people now?
We knew the people who were responsible for, or some of the people who were responsible for smuggling the books to Prague. But we didn't know how they did it. We suspected that it had something to do with Canadian diplomats.
Well, one of them is sitting right here, actually. Peter, can you tell your stories on the record?
I didn't want to know, because I am inclined to get tipsy sometimes, and I didn't want to betray anything, you know, because they had ears everywhere, you know. We knew some of the ears also.
Well, just to introduce Peter for a quickly in a slightly different context, when I played with this rock band, the Plastic People of the Universe, they threw me out, and I published some of their music and used the profits from that to buy instruments, which we then had to smuggle back into the countryside somehow. And I bought a keyboard, which I took to Hungary. I met some of the guys in the band. They tried to get it across the border, but the Czechs wouldn't let them take it across. So I was stuck with this keyboard, and I left it in Vienna, and apparently...
That's where I picked it up.
That's where you picked it up. I didn't want to know either, but my son did. But tell us about this... these acts of daring do. How did this work?
Well, when I arrived in Prague in 1986, I didn't know too much about Czechoslovakia.
You were no longer Trotskyist, I take it.
I was no longer Trotskyist. Long gone. But I was arriving from Brazil, and so I was coming from a very vibrant society on a late August afternoon into this city that seemed to be exceedingly melancholy in the late summer sun and unnaturally quiet. And I felt very, very strange. And over the course of the next few weeks, I was talking to colleagues from the American embassies and British embassies, so I gradually started to get a feel for the way things were. And somebody asked me if I would like to meet somebody called Willem Prechen. Willem Prechen was a Czech historian who had left in the 70s, I believe. And he was quartered at a schloss owned by Karel Schwarzenberg, which you visited, in Scheinfeld.
This is in West Germany.
In West Germany. I went out into Bavaria and met with Willem. And I was aware that diplomats had been sort of bringing things in and out in dribs and drabs. And he had a German diplomat, Wolfgang Scheuer, who had been carrying small packages backwards and forwards. And I talked with Willem for a while, and it occurred to me that this was a job that could be done a whole lot better, but that I was going to insist on a lot of operational security, which I did do. And over the course of the next 2 years, we moved 3.5 tons of material in and out of...
In diplomatic pouches?
No, in the back of my car. And we used to meet at different locations. This is what I mean about operational security. We didn't meet in the same place twice. And I would go out with manuscripts from inside the country, from Charter 77 and others. We would do the switch in West Germany, and he would put a ton of stuff into my vehicle. And it all went well until, it was going well until March 1988, when there was a conversation between Willem Prechen and the person who was my, for want of a better word, my cutout in Prague, Jiřina Šiklová, who subsequently became head of the sociology department at Charles University. And they were having a telephone conversation between Germany and Prague, and I didn't realize that they had given me a code name. I was Mrs. Tomanova. And unfortunately, the first street that I had lived on in Prague was Tomanova. And some bright guy at the STB said, "Eureka! We know who it is. We've got him." And they put out 3 teams into the streets of Prague, I think on the 5th of March. And they were going to intercept me as I was leaving with material. And just hours before the operation went into effect, the party leadership cancelled the whole thing because they were worried about the impact in Vienna of this event. So we carried on blissfully unaware that we'd essentially been discovered moving the stuff backwards and forwards in and out of the country. So it's kind of kind of amusing.
How did you find out that they discovered it then? Was this subsequently when you went into the records after 89?
There's an STB file on me, which is 300 pages long. And this whole incident is described in the STB file. And Willem Prechen and others are busy translating it into English right now because they're going to do some scholarship with the record.
It's amazing.
Are you going to write a book on that period?
I don't think so, no. In fact, I've been told essentially that we're not allowed to write memoirs.
It's perhaps worthwhile to mention that Peter Bakewell is still working as a career diplomat at the DFAT.
But I think the STV file will be working for something by Willem Prechen at some point. That will become available in some form.
So you were allowed to look into it?
If you're Czech, you can look into it.
That's right.
But I'm not allowed to look at it. But I will see the English translation in that which is being done here in Toronto.
I'm jealous because my STB file is only 30 pages long.
The funny thing is, what I don't understand, and I was saying this to Richard before, you know, what went out was relatively innocuous. I mean, it was manuscripts written by people who had something to say, and it was going to be published in the West and rebound and packaged and come back in. The logical thing would have been for them to intercept me at Rosvadov coming in, not in Prague going out, because what came in was much more interesting in many ways than what went out. because we also brought equipment of various kinds in on the inward runs, including radios and photocopy machines and that sort of thing. And the kids who would go on demonstrations would turn the radios on, and the signal could be picked up by Radio Free Europe. So for the first time, demonstrations were being heard live on radio just across the border. So, you know, had they intercepted me on coming in, they would have had a real haul, much more.
It's amazing the way technology helped along. When I was kicked out in 77, I went to London, and one of the first things I did was I bought a whole stack of these things called magic slates. I don't know whether you know what they are. These are children's toys where you have there's a wooden pencil on one side, and you can write on it, and you lift the plastic sheet up and the message disappears. And I sent several dozen of these in by another route, they cut them up into small squares, and there were hundreds of these magic slates around. And then when people were having meetings in houses, they would talk normally until it came to the time and the place that they were going to meet or some vital information. They would simply write it down in this little magic slate and then lift it up, and it would disappear again. I was told by using a sheet clover that it saved an awful lot of toilet flushing and note eating and so on. So, but that was the low tech version of that. But
I just wanted to say two things. One is that I sort of was peripherally involved with Zigzag Publishers, and I think what yourself and maybe even more Zdena tapes is a publishing achievement of Olympic proportions. I really mean it. The other thing I would like to say is, of course, Josef and Zdena Škoreský were the only one who sort of brought quite a lot with themselves to Canada. There was Karel Anfele, you know, who was for many years conductor of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. There were more than 100,000 physicians who came after 68. And there was, for example, Professor Šerek of the University of Toronto, who with his wife, and they were a fantastic Slovak scientific team. I worked with one of the Nobel Prize winners, Banting and the Institute. So there were so many people who really did so much in Canada. It was very nice of Canada to let them in, but they paid back, and paid back very heavily.
Well, the interesting thing about this whole period from 1968 after the Indian invasion right up until 1989 was just how great the cooperation was between the exile communities and the dissidents. And I don't think that things would have turned out exactly the way they had without that cooperation.
Of course.
And these were very sophisticated forms of communication that were not created by one person. They simply evolved in the course of this whole thing. I mean, and this is one of the things that I've taken away from this whole thing. When you talk about regime change, I look at it as something that happens first of all from within. And if it's not there to begin with, then it's almost impossible to impose it from the outside. And one of the remarkable things about not just Czechoslovakia, but also Poland and Hungary, especially those three countries, there was this tremendous symbiosis or connection between the exile communities. They weren't governments in exile the way they were in World War II, but they were publishers in exile and
political humble.
Exactly, and probably that's why it worked out as well as it did, because it was a spontaneous thing that was done by people because they really believed in what they were doing. It was not something that any governments paid for, although certainly, there was support from governments for this. But it was something that was done more or less on a shoestring, I think. Absolutely. And definitely, 68 Publishers is one of the high points in that. So I think we've maybe talked enough, and we can.
Yeah. I would definitely like to invite anybody who has any more questions.
I have one quick question. Just watching that film and thinking back to 68 and listening to you folks, it sounded like everybody was rather expecting the invasion, much more so than came across in the film. The film made it seem as though that there was a wonderful August and suddenly there were tanks. And yet, I think I heard from all of you that it was almost inevitable, for one thing. And if that's the case, I guess my follow-up question is, was anything done to prepare at least the folks in Prague for this kind of invasion?
I may actually pick up on this question because it's
something what I heard several historians talking about the divisions in the Russian leadership or Soviet leadership at that time. And allegedly there was a big quarrel about what to do with the so-called Czechoslovak crisis at that time between Kosygin, who was the prime minister, and Brezhnev and other people in the Politburo. Allegedly it was not exactly as Vaculík was saying, we are hanging by the hair, but allegedly there was a pretty big margin of error for Czechoslovakia at that time, what they could do. So do you think it was inevitable what happened, or was it something?
No, it
wasn't,
because if you take the case of Poland, in other words, Moscow managed to persuade the generals, the army, to step in. In other words, they had somebody inside who took over from and avoided an occupation. So maybe they were trying to get somebody within the party to stage some sort of coup in within the party, within the Politburo.
They had some people within the party, yeah. But they failed.
They failed.
And
not only that, I mean, Communist Party leaderships do sort of take their time and argue and, Tiananmen Square, when you look back at it, these people were in the square for God knows for weeks while the Communist Party leadership debated what to do. And then, of course, when they decide, by that time it's too late and they really crack down. The same thing in Tibet. There was, there were sort of peaceful demonstrations and then somebody started throwing stones and the cops actually, the army retired, phoned or whatever it is, emailed Beijing and said, what do we do? So the Communist Party leadership met and for a couple of days nothing happened, which the Tibetans took as an invitation and the riots started and they stoned Chinese shops, and the next thing you knew, they were killing Chinese shopkeepers. And then, of course, the Chinese reacted, oh my God, there's a pogrom on the Chinese in Lhasa. So it isn't as if the leadership of the Communist Party is uniform. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But, David, to answer your question, I can't answer your question, but I spent my first year, the year of the Prague Spring, 50% of my time in Brno and 50% of my time in Prague. And what you're getting in that film is the atmosphere in Prague. Brno, in Moravia, people were much more skeptical. And I don't know whether this is a natural thing or whether there's something in the atmosphere of Prague that kind of encourages this kind of wild enthusiasm. But I would go from Brno, where people were saying, oh man, if you read the action program, which came out in April of 1968, they said it's terrible. It's terrible. Nothing is going to happen. They still want to keep power. And you go to Prague, and they would say, "Oh, the action program doesn't mean a damn thing." And people, they were actually, it was a different mood in different parts of the country. I actually never met anyone who said the Russians are going to come for sure. But that was because of the people that I was associating with were students of mine who may not have wanted to say that out loud. Or they were people who didn't really care what was happening. They were just happy that it was,
just
the atmosphere was better, right?
I have a first
question,
actually.
Yes.
In 1956, the Russians had entered Hungary, right?
Yes.
But by 1989, Hungary was a much freer country. It had a very different system.
Gulag communism, you mean?
Yeah, but it's interesting you know, is why, you know, there's Poland, Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic, Hungary. This thing developed or evolved in very different ways. Now, why did it evolve in this particularly harsh way in Czechoslovakia?
Joe, maybe you touched on that before.
No,
before you arrived.
Czechoslovakia was harsher than 56? No.
No,
after
by 1989,
okay. In the 80s in Prague, too, there was this thing of pointing at the Poles and saying, and the Poles were acting up, there was, you know, the solidarity and all that sort of thing was brewing in Poland after John Paul II. I mean, I was with John Paul II in Poland when he went there in 79, etc. Right. And the ferment, in Poland, the ferment came up from the bottom. From the bottom up. In Czechoslovakia, it came from Havel and other people like that. Well, not in 68. But by the 80s, it was like, look at those Poles. See, they're starving. You've got your party and your, you know, party are people. Sorry.
Sausage and beer.
You have your sausages. You don't have goulash, but you have your sausages. And the Poles don't.
Right. Well, I remember when I was at university, I had a Don who was going one summer. He was going to go to Poland, and then he was going to go to Czechoslovakia because he wanted to see the good and the bad of communism. And he told me this joke, which I also heard, you know, in Eastern Europe. There are two dogs meet on the Polish-Czech border. Polish-Czechoslovak border, and there's the Czech dog is going to Poland, and the Polish dog is coming to Czechoslovakia, and the Polish dog says, why are you coming to us? He said, because I want to, the Czech dog says to the Polish dog, why are you coming to our country? And he said, because I want to eat. And the Polish dog says, and why are you coming to us? And he says, because I want to bark. there was definitely not a lockstep, and it probably goes back to what you said, Joe, that there's a different sort of cultural background.
Yeah, the Czech cavalry didn't charge against the German tanks.
That's right.
Also, I think that Poles have many more people than we have, and also they have faith. Religion is a great force.
Yes. And the Catholic Church was still strong as a kind of a counterbalance, I guess. But
And the Poles had John Paul II.
And they had John Paul II, yes.
And the communists were scared of them.
Yeah.
And it was fun to watch the communist paparazzis paying obeisance to the Pope. You know what was fun to watch in 88? Going to Communist Party, get Petro was interviewing Jakesh, the Secretary General of the Communist Party, and him sort of saying, we made mistakes in 68, you know. But it was necessary at the time, but, you know.
Yeah. So,
I have a question, if I may, for Mr. Schlesinger. You mentioned the historic dimension and the national DNA kind of thing, and I would like you to comment on if you think that this part of our history is somehow bound to repeat itself. We all, I think, hold that it is not, but we have a lot of disconnect in the society about young people supposedly not caring, not knowing what happened. And I wonder if we move 20 years ahead in time from today, and we talk about the events of 1968, what do you think is our current generation, your generation and maybe my generation, because I am like the tail, I was 6 years old in 1968, and what would your message be to the future generations to sort of watch out for the historical development that leads to events like Prague Spring, or it's...
Well, first of all, being 80, I don't understand 20-year-olds anyway. and 80-year-olds don't. But, you know... Okay, I'll take... Because I was there just a few weeks ago, I'll take China. I was in China for the Cultural Revolution, for... ping-pong diplomacy and all that, and the Mao, and all these things. And the last time I was there 37 years ago, and worked there for 2 years, and the last time I was there was in 73, you know, that was 35 years ago. But I remember doing one of the reports I did then was on a place called Tsinghua University. And my story then, it's on tape, it's on film, started out, this is a Chinese university, and you see European post, character posters, blah, blah, blah. And the next shot says, they build trucks here. And the whole thing was that the qualification for getting this university was to be a proletarian, and then manual labor. And on the side, maybe they started to make it. So I went back this time. Wow. It is like the Harvard of China. You take competitive Confucian exams, imperial exams, and the top, you know, 0.1% of the kids get in there. You go to a class, and there is a Canadian by the name of Daniel Bell who teaches political philosophy. And what he teaches them is Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill, all the rest of it. And these kids lap it up, etc. And they speak English, and they criticize the government, they're very self-talk. They criticize the government limits, of course. You don't talk about the Tiananmen Square massacre, you don't talk about your Tibet very much, you don't talk about the fact that 20, 30 million people... No, you talk about the fact that 20, 30 million people died in the Great Famine of 1958. But of course it was a natural disaster, so not Mao's fault. And these people are so optimistic that they can do whatever they want to do. And you say to yourself, how can, in the end, a regime, you have a Chinese regime that has to survive, it has to survive by bringing more prosperity to more people, because hundreds of millions have left out. So they need a more efficient society. To get the creativity of a more efficient society, they need to loosen up. How to control these things? How, you take the case of the Shah of Iran, who also westernized and sent people abroad to universities he wanted to teach things. And these people came back from Vienna and other universities, from Frankfurt, and they were the seed that started the revolution against the Shah. And you sort of wonder whether this new generation, whether they'll put up with some of the nonsense that's going on in China. Because what you have is a communist party that is a communist in name only. It is just a dictatorship. Not a totalitarian dictatorship, but not an absolutist dictatorship, but autocratic. And you wonder how long it can go on. So I don't know how people react, how generations reacted in Germany, for instance. How I covered Germany for a while, and how Germans in East Germany reacted differently to Germans in West Germany. You know, there was more rightist skinheads in East Germany, in one East German town, and probably the whole of West Germany, I don't know. So, I don't know how the young will react. I wish I knew. Not only that, hey, I'm a journalist. All I have to do is say, this thing has happened. I don't go around forecasting things.
Thank you very much. I think Joe mentioned the goulash communism. So before I invite you to the piglet democracy, I would like to thank the partners of this evening, who were Czech Tourism, whose director is sitting among us over there, Mirjana Sibek. Another partner of this evening was Matoni, which is the best mineral water in the world, and you should be able to taste it. Also, one of the most important sponsor of tonight was Pilsner Urquell, and I want to tell you that this best beer in the world, obviously, has been released in keg. The first keg of Pilsner Urquell was released this morning at 10 o'clock. We were really praying for last month that we get the first keg for this evening, and I'm very happy to announce you that it arrived this morning at 11 to my house, and I had the first one by 10:30.
Bravo!
Starting 21st of August, we really timed it well, so we can say that this is our perfectly designed PR campaign. Soviets came to Prague 40 years ago. Pilsner is coming to Toronto 40 years later. So on 21st we will have 5 or 6 restaurants starting serving the Pilsner on draft in Toronto. Last but not least, actually the most importantly, I would like to thank you who came. Thank you very much for your attention. But most importantly, thank you to Joe Schlesinger, Peter Bakewell, Joe Skvoretsky, Joe Čermák, and Paul Wilson for giving us this wonderful time. Thank you very much.
So now we sing Roll Out the Barrel.
So the democracy is waiting outside.
I'll let you.